Hello, everybody out there. I was just, what's it called, reminiscing, because today is the Abbey's 22nd birthday. Yeah, when I had been staying in Boise with the potatoes, you know, the main crop in Idaho. And then we drove up from Boise together with Manjushri and Achala. Yeah, not the deities, the cats. Yeah, and yeah, they were, I don't know, Achi kind of slept most of the ride. Manji was restless, yeah. And we got here, and of course they hid the first thing, you know, how cats are scared. Yeah, and we got here in the evening, went to bed, got up in the morning, you know, did some practice, ate breakfast, and then we looked at each other, you know, the group from Seattle, and we said, what should we do? And we all instantly ran to the curtains. We didn't even need to talk about it. Yeah, the curtains were an interesting design on the cloth. Yeah, and we wanted to take the mat down ASAP. You remember the curtains, Trace?
I like the curtains.
Oh! You like the curtains, okay. So, yeah, oh, we should have given them to you. Yeah.
We could show photos of the curtains.
Oh, yeah, they're so interesting, yeah. Yeah, and yes, and then we began the process of moving in everything. Well, there wasn't a lot to move in. Yeah, and Tracy and Alice had actually prepared a lot, you know. The fridge was full, there were towels and soap in the bathrooms. Thank you, yeah. So for 22 years, over 22 years, Tracy has been helping to take care of us, you know, always with so much kindness and generosity. So thank you, yeah. And okay, and also so many thanks to everybody who has contributed to the Abbey in whatever way, you know, volunteering, doing mailings, proofreading, donating, yeah, bringing up all sorts of stuff, yeah. So yeah, we are a dependently arising phenomena. And tomorrow night's talk is going to be about dependent arising. So it's a good balance. Okay, so today we will do our prayers, our recitations, and yes, then we will continue with the super knowledges, the six super knowledges. I'll take a moment and review the supernormal powers, which was the first one. But let's do the chanting first. Let's create our motivation. So with everything that is going on in the country now, it would be very easy for us to slip into creating friends and enemies, to become very black and white in our way of thinking. Certain things are good, certain things are bad, as if they were all inherently existent. So, but while we can say that from the appearance, the actual action that we saw, that usually is considered a negative action, we don't know the minds of the people who do those actions. And according to the motivation, that's how an action should really be evaluated. But in any case, if people are doing cruel actions, what appears to be cruel actions, to realize that they are unhappy, they're confused, they think that doing those actions will bring them some happiness in this life, and so they go ahead. So we need to differentiate the action and say it's harmful if done with the intent to harm others, or to say it's virtuous if there was a dire circumstance and somebody was helping somebody else with a kind motivation. None of those actions are the people who do them. So the action and the agent of the action are different. So we can talk about an action and its benefits or its faults, but that is different than the person. A negative action doesn't make the person evil. A virtuous action doesn't make that person an angel. So we have to see that in samsara, all beings are equal in wanting happiness and not suffering. And even when we do something negative, which we all wind up doing under the power of afflictions, that doesn't mean we're evil. And similarly, when others do things that we disapprove of, the action and the person are different. The person still has Buddha nature. The action is non-virtuous, but the person is not evil. And so in that way, we can cultivate compassion for people who are suffering, who are confused, who think doing certain actions will bring them happiness when in fact it doesn't. So having compassion for everybody, and then this is an attitude that saves us from having the attitude that we so dislike in other people when it's black and white, good and bad. If you're not on my side, then you're on the other side and you're an enemy, that way of thinking. So it enables us to have a kind heart for others and still hold ethical values. And so then we can spread that compassion to more and more beings, up that compassion, so that we want to help them be free of samsara and then generate the bodhicitta motivation, aspiring for full awakening. So I was thinking about that today, just as a way of, not on the topic, but introducing, because I watched online a few clips of ICE pinning people to the ground and arresting them and pushing them and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it was really disheartening, you know, to see this kind of thing going on in the country. And then I started thinking about, well, why, you know, what kind of mind does an ICE agent have who's doing this? Yeah, because in the video clips, I mean, they're big guys, and the people they're pinning to the ground, sometimes it's big guys, but sometimes it's very thin women who weigh half as much as they do, and they feel that they can pin her to the ground, and then two or three of them sit on her. It really not necessary. But so I started to think, okay, well, how does somebody become an ICE officer? What would make somebody to do it? And now, you know, they're trying to hire more people, so they're offering, I think, a $50,000 bonus just for starting the job. So you might have a bunch of people who need the money really badly for their family, and so they sign up. You know, maybe they have no wish to do immigration control, but they need the money, yeah. Then you have somebody who maybe has some bias against immigrants, or somebody who has a lot of anger and, you know, oh, okay, then I get to take it out and, you know, push these people around and, you know, I'm like this. And you know, they're caring. I mean, they're military people on the streets, you know, with all their military things here and their belt with all the things hanging off the belt and carrying, you know, an assault weapon or whatever they have, complete with their big, you know, helmets and masked, you know, something masked up to here. You know, and, you know, how? What's going on in somebody's mind who is doing that job? How do they feel about what they're doing? Some people probably feel I'm serving the country or I'm serving the president, you know? And other people, like I said, probably just, you know, my family needs the money. And, you know, other people, well, my dad did this, so I have to carry on the family tradition. Or, who knows? Yeah, so many different motivations. And these are individual people, and it's really unfair to lump them all together or to think that the action we see them do on TV is the only thing they do in their life. Yeah, they don't. They go home to their families. You know, I'm sure they're kind to, you know, I hope they're kind to their families. Yeah. So, yeah, to have compassion rather than anger, rather than seeking to retaliate. Okay. So I was reading His Holiness's book, Beyond Religion, and he has a chapter in it about justice, which I found very interesting because in all the years of studying the Dharma, I've never heard anyone of my teachers mention the word justice in a teaching. I've never heard them talk about justice. Yeah. And His Holiness in the book is saying that the basis of the ethical conduct that he advocates, which is secular, you know, ethics, is compassion. Because compassion is something that everybody needs and everybody can feel. Yeah. So justice, you know, just we often think of justice as meaning punishment, getting even. inflicting harm on someone. Yeah. So I think that's one reason I don't use the word justice, because that's, you know, such a common idea. Yeah. Justice means you get even. And we, one of the inmates that I corresponded with for a number of years, some years ago, got executed because of the justice system. Yeah. But actually, his public defender at the end was not so sure that he committed the crime that he was killed for. She was investigating it and, you know, found some reasons why some other people would do it. So was that justice? Who knows, you know? And is justice meaning retaliation actually something that fits with our own ethical values? You know, what I find interesting in Nagarjuna's precious garland, there's, you know, he talks about karma, he talks about emptiness, he talks about the 32 marks of the Buddha, and he also talks about the prison system, you know, and, you know, he says sometimes people need to be incarcerated, but not to harm them or punish them, but for their own safety, so that they don't create the negative karma of doing an action, a harmful action again. So you're protecting them and you're protecting the would-be victim. Yeah. So it's not done with vengeance and joy, oh, we got you, slam, lock, throw away the key. Yeah. And he said that I think, you know, every so often, people should really evaluate whether that person who was incarcerated still needs to be incarcerated, or have they changed? Yeah. And if they've changed, you should let them go free. If after a number of years, you know, their minds still have not changed, you know, then you may have to banish them. Because in, you know, ancient India, there were vast swatches of land that were unowned by anybody. Yeah, so, and you didn't have to cross borders or stuff like that. And he said, let them go to another place and start over again. Yeah, because here everybody knows them. They really don't have a chance. But maybe you have to let them go. They go to another place. They have to start their life anew. And so they think, oh, okay, I'm going to try it a different way this time. Yeah. So that's what I found in Buddhist texts so far. Yeah. Interesting. Very different than our system, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So we've been talking about the second of the three higher trainings, the higher training in concentration. And after talking about how to generate serenity and how you go actualize the dhyanas and then the formless realm absorptions, and then we talked about the 20 sanghas, remember? Yeah, the leaping ones and the, yeah. And then the section we started last time was on the six super knowledges. Okay, so the first one is supernormal powers, and that's the one we talked about last time. Yeah, so you know, you can have one body, you can make your body into another body, or having many bodies, consolidate them in one body. You can walk through walls, walk on water, fly in the sky, cross your legs and just fly in the sky. You don't need to sit in an airplane on one of those uncomfortable seats, but nobody comes by and asks you if you want something to drink. Yeah, but I guess you might be able to manifest that while you're flying. But what's interesting, when they talked about how you gain those qualities, it's not by doing something with your body. The principal cause is by the power of your concentration. Yeah. So I find that quite interesting, because we usually think, oh, if you can do something physically, it's because you've been physically training your body. But for, you know, to walk on water, it isn't like you start practicing with puddles and then you progress to, you know, walking on the water in the bathtub or something, you know. It's done through the power of your samadhi. Yeah. And so all the other powers that are to come also, it's through the power of concentration. Yeah. So I imagine there's probably some other instructions that come when you come close to being able to do that. Yeah. Okay, then the second one is the divine ear, or clairaudience. Okay, clairaudience, clear hearing. So with the divine ear, meditators can hear sounds in the heavenly realm, human world, and all other realms and directions where sentient beings dwell. It's interesting, in the evening chant, we say that we are, how does it go, with these precious verses, pervading the heavens above and pervading the realms below, you know? So we want all these living beings to hear what we're saying. These meditators with the divine ear can hear what's going on in these different realms. So we're sending it there, you know, they're hopefully hearing, you know, well, the people who live in those realms hopefully will hear it, but maybe some others with clear audience will as well. Okay, so these meditators can hear sounds, listen to conversations, and hear cries of pleasure or pain that are far away as easily as ones nearby. So don't think that you're ever having a private conversation, because you don't know who's listening in. I think I'm kind of joking there, because I think, you know, I wouldn't think that people who have these just go around listening in randomly. But, you know, if you're practicing the Bodhisattva path, yeah, it's very helpful to, you know, be able to do this, because you can know what questions your students have, what things they don't understand. You can go to teachings yourself, you know, through clear audience. So it's a very helpful ability. Okay. So the Majjhima Nikaya says, with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, they hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. Yeah, so you can hear all of that. Now, these people are also meditators, so that's why I don't think they're just randomly checking out what's going on, you know, or listening to, you know, somebody just gave out a new album, you know. I don't think that's going on. But, you know, if you use it to benefit sentient beings, it can be very helpful. Okay, then so that's the second one. The third super knowledge is understanding the minds of others. Okay, and so with this super knowledge, meditators, and now there's a quote from the Majjhima Nikaya, the meditators know the way to understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with their own minds. I don't think that means that you wrap your mind around somebody else's mind, that kind of encompassing, but that, you know, you're able to understand that person's mind. They understand a mind afflicted by lust as affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust. They understand a mind affected by hate as affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as unaffected by hate. So they don't make mistakes in their cognition about what's going on in people's minds. They understand a mind affected by confusion as affected by confusion, and a mind uninfected by confusion as unaffected by confusion. They understand a contracted mind, when your mind's contracted and tight and narrow and, you know, can't take in anything else. They understand a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as distracted. They understand an exalted mind as exalted. Exalted means having perceived emptiness, and an unexalted mind as unexalted. They understand a surpassed mind as surpassed, so surpassing different stages on the path, and an unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. They understand a concentrated mind as concentrated, and an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. So when our mind is wandering in daydreaming, yeah, anybody who is observing our mind, then they can tell that. And when our mind is virtuous, they can also know that. They understand a liberated mind as liberated, and an unliberated mind as unliberated. So they also know who is free of samsara and who is not free of samsara. And then His Holiness says, with this super-knowledge, meditators know the mental states of others as clearly as they see a spot on their own face, reflected in a clean, bright mirror. For example, if another person's mind is affected by attachment or anger, they know it as such. If it is free from those, they also know that. Wow, well, that would be helpful, wouldn't it? To be able to know other people's minds, you know, when you're talking with them and discussing something, to know, yeah, what are they really thinking? Why are they thinking that? Maybe somebody is, you know, really clinging to an idea, and like, well, why are they clinging to that idea? You know, to know that. Or if somebody looks cheerful, but maybe it's a cover for what's really going on in them. Or if somebody's having a pity party, you know, what do they need? So for people, you know, if you have the attitude wanting to benefit others, these kind of skills are very helpful. Yeah, if you're just somebody generating these powers for the heck of it, because you like to. I don't think many people would really put in the time and energy to develop that deep of samadhi just to, you know, because they wanted to eavesdrop. They would probably do something online easier, you know, quicker. Okay, then the fourth super knowledge. This is recollection of past lives. So this one, right before the Buddha attained awakening under the Bodhi tree, he gained three higher knowledges. So, or not three, yeah, higher knowledges, yeah, that are also super knowledges. Yeah. So this is one of them. the recollection of past lives. And so when you read the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, when he sat there, you know, first the Maras came and bugged him. And after he dealt with them, well, they did bug him, didn't they? Yeah, pretty bad. Kind of, you know, like it looked like external beings coming to bug him. It was actually his own attachment and his own hatred, you know, and those things manifesting, and then, of course, him dealing with those things and banishing them. Okay. So after he did that, then he gained this realization of knowing his own past lives. Okay. Now, I remember one time, you know, giving a talk to a group of people, and one young man came up afterwards and said, I went to one of these courses or, you know, workshops where you can see your own past life. Yeah. And he said, I saw that I killed somebody in a past life, and I feel horrible. I cannot forgive myself. Yeah. So, you know, he was just so horrified that in a previous life he had done that, that the horror of knowing that or thinking that he knew that affected this life, even though, you know, this life he didn't hurt anybody. Yeah. So there's, you know, these courses that they have for seeing your past lives. I think you have to be very careful. You know, with this man, I don't know if he really saw his past life or if, you know, maybe he was in a bad mood that day and so that's what his mind dreamt up, or who knows, yeah. But he was taking it very seriously. So I think it's... you know, when you hear these things advertised in the New Age newspaper, don't be so quick to sign up, because you don't know the abilities of the people leading these. And they, you know, if you're, yeah, doing it correctly or not. Also, you know, just think for a minute. Yeah, are you ready to know your past lives, not just one life, but like many, many, many? I mean, think of the qualities you need inside to be able to not freak out like this young man did by knowing your previous lives. And they say, we've been everything and done everything in samsara. Yeah, I think you would need quite a bit of merit and quite a bit of emotional maturity and dharma wisdom to be able to bear seeing, you know, clearly what you've done in a previous life. I know, one way that I'm dealing with what's happening now in the country is I think, okay, one time in a previous life, I was an authoritarian ruler. I was a dictator. And, you know, using the example of what I see now, I think this is what I did in a previous life. And I think like this because then when I'm doing purification practice, I have something to purify that is not from this life, you know, that is certainly much more serious and deserving of purification than what I've done in this life. And I also, you know, so I confess it, you know, I can't remember specific instances, but I confess it, you know, because I must have done something in beginningless lifetimes like that. And I never want to do that again, you know, because I can see the effects on other people, on society, on a whole planet, and I never want to create havoc in multiple people's lives by being an authoritarian ruler or a dictator in the future. So in that way, you know, I don't really know what I've been, yeah, but I use it for purification. I find it very helpful, very effective. Now, if I were to actually have that ability to see, you know, in 3D color things that I did in previous lives, whoa, that would be heavy duty, you know, to see specific actions and know, oh my God, I did that. Yeah, cause that kind of devastation in somebody's life. Yeah. So I think you need, you know, a mental strength and merit to be able to bear this. Okay. So here's the quote from the Majjhima Nikaya, what it says about recollection of past lives. The way to recollect their manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, .. 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction and expansion. So that's how many lives they know. Yeah. Then what they know about each of those lives is, there I was named, I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere. And there too, I was so named so-and-so, .. all those other things, and passing away from there, I reappeared here, and so on and on. You know, seeing, being born, your name, your family, your social status, your education level, what you did in those lives, yeah, how you were regarded, what pleasure and pain you experienced, what pleasure and pain you caused others. Yeah, and then remembering that you died and then got reborn in another birth. Okay, thus with their aspects and particulars, they recollect their manifold past lives. Is this something you want to do? Yeah, would you be ready to do it today? No. No. Yeah. Because I think, you know, to do this, to really see previous lives, being born, living, dying, bardo, birth, living, dying, bardo, birth, again and again, if that doesn't give you renunciation, well, first of all, if it doesn't scare the heebie-jeebies out of you, you know, which is what gives you renunciation, you know, when you see, like, you look at samsara with a sense of the horror that it is, yeah, then your renunciation is strong, and then, you know, your dharma practice really takes off, because you want to practice, you know, you are on fire, so to speak, because you know, you don't want to stay in samsara anymore and keep doing that. Did you? Okay. So this super knowledge gives meditators the ability to know particular details of their previous lives from long ago. The Path of Purification by Buddhaghosa says to develop this ability, a meditator must first master the dhyanas up to the fourth dhyana. Okay, so first you have to do that. Yeah. bringing the mind to imperturbability. So you have serenity, which permeates, you know, all the those meditative absorptions. Because the dhyanas are states of single-pointed concentration on one object, remembering previous lives, which involves turning the mind to many objects, cannot be done while in the fourth dhyana itself. Okay? So you don't do it when you're meditating, when your sphere of consciousness is like that, because at that time you're just focused on one object. Yeah? So you have to come out of, you have to have attained fourth dhyana, but then you have to come out of it, and with the mind that is not in a dhyana state, but having the carryover feeling from it, then you use that mind to start remembering back and back and back. Okay, it goes on to explain this here. Okay. So because the dhyanas are states of single-pointed concentration on one object, remembering previous lives, which involves turning the mind to many objects, thinking about each life and what happened, that cannot be done while in the fourth dhyana itself. Meditators must emerge from the fourth dhyana into a state of ordinary consciousness where the mind is still suffused with the power and clarity of the dhyana. So when they talk about coming out of different concentrations and meditative states, when you come out, you know, that we kind of joke about it, it's like a hangover, yeah, because you've come out of that state, but what was, the power of that concentration is still with you, it's still suffusing your mind. In the same way, sometimes in certain meditations, you're very concentrated, and when you get up, you know, the memory, the feeling from that meditation is still there with you. It's not like, oh, okay, I'm up, what's to eat? But like, oh, you know, something happened in your meditation. So like that, yeah, hangover, good kind of hangover, yeah. Okay. Meditators emerge from the fourth dhyana into a state of ordinary consciousness so that they can think about many different objects, where the mind is still suffused with the power and clarity of the dhyana. They begin by recalling what took place just before their meditation session. Then remember what happened before that, gradually extending their memory as far back as possible to events from childhood and infancy. How many of you can remember being like 1 year old or 2 years old? Maybe, yeah? Okay, what happened? Tell us about it.
Running around and got lost.
When you were when you were 1 year old,
two,
you could two, run?
Two.
Two?
Two, okay. Yeah. So okay. Running around and then got lost and got somewhere. Lost. Yeah.
Yeah. You were scared probably.
Yes.
Yes. That's why you remember it. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. But remembering far back is, to 1 year old, to being in the womb, difficult. Yeah. So you can imagine that. That gets you going. Okay. It isn't necessary to remember every detail of every day. And this is how you generate it, okay? It's not necessary to remember every detail of every day. Sometimes they remember larger segments of their life, such as being a young adult or an adolescent. Whenever their memory becomes cloudy, they pause and enter the fourth dhyana, to refresh, strengthen, and purify their mind. So that's the effect of the concentration, okay, to refresh, strengthen, and purify the mind, so that then when they start looking back in time, the mind is clearer and can see things. Reemerging again from the dhyana, they take up recollecting events in their lives from where they left off, going back to the time of birth, life in the womb, and up to the time of conception, when the consciousness first entered the union of egg and sperm of this life. Now, what would that feel like to remember that? How, what, because at that time, you know, do you have language? You know, you don't have the language of this life. Would you have the language of your previous life? How would you, you know, see that? Would you be able to give it a name or have a conception of it? It's interesting. You know, how would you perceive those things? Okay. At this time, they get to the time when the consciousness first entered the union of egg and sperm of this life. At this time, after they've been going back, it seems as if they come up against a wall and cannot remember further back. But without giving up, they again enter the fourth dhyana to refresh the mind and make it focused, sharp, and clear. Emerging from that dhyana again, they again try to recall what happened in the moment before rebirth, the moment before conception. They apply their mind with determination to break through the wall that obstructs memory until eventually the concentrated mind is able to penetrate the fog of forgetfulness and recollect the last moment of the previous life or the last moment of the bardo. They continue progressing back in time, gradually remembering events from previous life, Again encountering the wall of obscuration when they reach the beginning of that life, they persevere, sharpening and purifying the mind by entering the fourth dhyana for a period of time. They then resume the recollection process until they can recall the second preceding life. And so on, they practice, developing the ability to remember vividly thousands, if not millions or billions, of previous lives. Woo! I wonder if you see like that many lives when you come out of it. Can you remember what you saw and describe all of those lives? Yeah, like what exactly do they remember? And do you remember just events? Do you remember what you thought? Yeah, be interesting. One day, probably not so soon, but one day. Okay. So that was the fourth one, remembering previous lives. Then the fifth one is called divine eye or clairvoyance. We often in English use the word clairvoyance for any kind of supernatural power, but here it has a specific meaning. It's not the same as divine ear. It's not the same as recollecting lives or supernormal powers, okay? So the divine eye or clairvoyance. The divine eye gives meditators access to the death and rebirth of sentient beings. So in the previous one, remembering previous lives, You got to know your own death and rebirth. Now you're knowing other sentient beings' death and rebirth, who they were born, when they died, who they were born after that, and so on. Yeah, can you imagine that? Looking around and like, that you know, I think in many ways would be very helpful for realizing emptiness, in the sense, yeah, that if you can remember all those lifetimes, then you realize that people are just karmic bubbles. Yeah, that there's no real person there going from one lifetime to the next. Yeah, it's just karma ripens and there's a lifetime, that karma comes to an end, they die, you know, different karma ripens, they get another lifetime, and so on. And you see, you know, in each lifetime they appear as a real, inherently existent person. But if they were a real, inherently existent person, they couldn't die, because things that are inherently existent don't depend on other things. Yeah, but here they are, they're seeing that they get reborn, they die, you know. So who's doing that? And what is each lifetime a real person? Or is each lifetime, yeah, a karmic bubble? The karma ripens and creates the appearance of a person like that. So that actually all of us now, we feel like, I am here, I'm a real person. But all we are is basically a manifestation of whatever karma happened to ripen. Yeah. And then sometime in the future, some other, you know, well, karma's ripening all the time, but sometime in the future, other karma will ripen for another rebirth. Is it still you going from one life to the next? Yeah. Okay. So here's from the Majjhima Nikaya what it says about the divine eye. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, they see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, like in terms of knowledge, social class, health, those things, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. They understand how beings pass on according to their actions thus. These worthy ones who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of Aryas, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination. Dot, dot, dot. But these worthy ones who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of Aryas, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have appeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Dot, dot, dot. And these meditators understand how beings pass on according to their actions. Now, what do you think having that power would be like? Yeah? You could see, you know, all the people, if you have attachment, you know, if you have this strong of attachment, it'd probably be difficult to generate this power, you know. But let's say, you know, you had attachment to somebody, you could see exactly when, you know, when they're going to die, or, you know, what they were before this life, you know. oh, this person you love so much now was a donkey. Yeah? Or they were who knows what. They were, yeah, an authoritarian ruler. You know, we go up and down in this and that in samsara all the time. It's not like we're on this upward path. Yeah, I think the Hindus say, you know, you kind of keep going up on, as you take one birth after the next, but not in Buddhism. You know, it depends which karma ripens at the time of death. Yeah. And so here you can see, not only for yourself, but other people, what people did in various lifetimes, you know, because it takes the lifetime, many different actions conducted in many different lifetimes, you know, and here these different actions came together and that person gets this lifetime with these kind of events happening in it. Yeah. Again, I think you would have to, that is something, yeah, which I would think would definitely make you meditate on compassion. If you could see the, you know, what people were and what actions they created and what they were reborn. Yeah, how are you going to react to that? Compassion. Yeah. Okay, the attainment of the divine eye, which sees beings dying and reappearing in their next life according to their karma. Wow. According to their karma. So no matter how much you care for them, no matter how much you dislike them, they're reborn according to their karma. Yeah? People often come and ask me, what can I do to help my dear one who died? Yeah. Well, they've most often been reborn, or they're in the bardo. And, you know, we can do some prayers and dedicate the merit for them. But I think the real time to help other people is when they're alive, and so you encourage them to do virtuous actions, not encourage them to do non-virtue. In, you know, it's interesting in families, so often because people, their outlook is just the happiness of this life, they don't think about multiple lives, then what the family dynamics do is help everybody create the causes for lower rebirth. Yeah, because parents have to go to work, so to make, you know, you have kids, so you have to go to work, so, you know, maybe you leave early, you put false hours in, you lie, you teach your kids how to lie. You know, in my age, your parent, if you missed school, you had to have a note from your parent. You know, but the parent, the kids see the parents lying, and so they think, oh, well, I can do that too. You know, or you, somebody in the family wants to spend money in one way and other people get angry at them. Yeah. So often, you know, we wish people well, but what do we get them involved in doing? Like your friends, you know, think of your old friends, yeah? You wish them well, don't you? You like those people. What activities did you do with those people? Anybody brave enough to say yes?
Venerable, we used to play a game called Cards Against Humanity that was...
Called what?
Cards Against Humanity.
Oh.
Which is basically a whole game of harsh speech.
Okay. Yeah. But it...
Yeah, with the people I used to hang around with, we drank, we smoked, we killed fish, we hunted deer, we sat around and played cards and wasted time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, idle talk and harsh speech and divisive speech.
I didn't understand that last part.
Idle talk, harsh speech, divisive speech.
Yeah. Yeah. Intoxicants, lying, maybe, you know, shoplifting. Yeah. Lying on forms that you're supposed to fill out. You know, who knows? You know, when we think, our friends, the people we care about, what would did we lead them to do? So much negative karma, and how they're reborn accordingly. And then the karma they create in that next life, planting more seeds for more rebirth. And if, you know, they still haven't learned anything about the law of karma and its effects, or not have even another religion that, that teaches you some ethical thing, or not having secular ethics, then, you know, you just kind of wander one life to the next doing all sorts of negative things, thinking you're having a good time. Yeah, you're having a good time. Or maybe, you know, you're really ambitious and you want high status, so you lie, you pretend to be somebody you're not. Yeah, and you lead everybody else. So, yeah. So you can see if you have, you can see why it's important not to just do these past life kind of things with some guy from an ad you read in the New Age newspaper. Yeah, because you're not sure if you're, well, you know, I don't know if you could really see any of those things without that ability, but who knows what your mind comes up with about how you acted and what you did. The attainment of the divine eye, which sees beings dying and reappearing in their next life according to their karma, brings several special abilities. They understand clearly how sentient beings are governed and controlled by their karma. Wouldn't that be helpful in your practice to have 100% conviction about the law of karma and its effects? How would that change how you lived your life? Yeah, if you really believe that your actions have an ethical dimension and are going to cause your happiness and suffering. They know their actions sentient beings did to cause rebirth in a particular realm during specific lives. They have the ability to see events in other realms in the universe, in places far away, and in other dimensions that our normal eyes are not privy to. So then you can also, with a divine eye, see the different realms of existence. So you can see spirits and nagas and devas and, you know, beings in the Brahma realm and so on. Yeah, you can see them, you know, like you look at the palm of your hand. For a Dharma teacher, this ability is especially useful because she can see various sentient beings and their karma and know their unique dispositions and how to skillfully benefit them. There are many stories in the sutras of the Buddha knowing by means of his divine eye which beings were receptive to the Dharma at that time and which and whose faculties were ripe to gain realizations if they were taught. So he could see that, you know, when he comes to the audience, you know the karma of all these people. And then you know kind of where somebody is, what they need to hear, and you can say the thing that they really need to hear that helps them at that time. By knowing which beings in other realms or universes are ripe to be led on the Dharma path, bodhisattvas with supernormal powers can go to those places to teach them. Okay, so if you have the divine eye and you see somebody in another universe, yeah, who has the karma to gain a certain kind of understanding, and you can see that you have a karmic link with that person from previous lives, then if you have supernormal powers, you know, the first of the super knowledges, then you can zip over to whatever realm they're in. And, you know, it may not even be a physical thing. We talk about Amitabha's Buddha land, you know, his pure land in the West. Is it really in the West? Or is Amitabha's pure land a mental state? Yeah, well, yeah, they do have some sort of physical body there, but, you know, you can maybe have different physical bodies, but it's still a mental state. I don't know how it works. Yeah. But the point is, you know, if you have great compassion for sentient beings, this gives you really the ability to benefit a lot of people. Okay, there are many stories in the sutras of the Buddha's knowing by means of his divine eye which beings were receptive to the Dharma at that time and whose faculties were ripe to gain realizations if they were taught. So he probably knew that about the first five disciples that he went to teach. Yeah. By knowing which beings in other realms or universes are ripe to be led on the Dharma path, bodhisattvas with supernormal powers can go to those places to teach them. Okay, the divine eye is attained by using the light kasina. Remember we talked about the kasinas? So by using the light kasina to enter the fourth dhyana, having developed a luminous mind, because probably of focusing on the light kasina, they emerge from the fourth dhyana and turn this inner perception of light outward using their clear and powerful minds to radiate this bright light that illuminates ever greater distances and extends to other realms of existence. Does that mean that ordinary beings can see that light? No. You know, and who knows if it's a physical light when they say radiate the bright light. It could be the power of the mind, the ability to know those things that extends to other realms of existence. Sometimes while extending light further, the mind becomes dull and the light cannot penetrate to reveal those realms and events. At that time, meditators again cultivate concentration with the light kasina and use it to enter the fourth dhyana. When their mind is refreshed and clear, they emerge from that dhyana and resume radiating the light. Eventually, this powerful samadhi can illuminate other realms that are ordinarily concealed, and meditators can see devas, hungry ghosts, hell beings, as well as human beings and animals in other parts of the universe. Fixing their attention on particular beings, they inquire, not by asking, I mentally, what is the karma that brought this being to be born in this realm of existence? Yeah. By the power of the divine eye, they gain direct understanding of this karma They see that those beings in unfortunate realms were born there owing to the power of specific destructive actions, and that those in fortunate realms attain such rebirths due to constructive actions. Some future events may become apparent as well. Okay, let's pause here. Do you have questions or comments? Yeah.
How does what you just described in terms of the light when cultivating the divine eye relate to the tantric visualizations of sending out light to different realms when doing mantra recitation?
It seems like they probably have some relationship, doesn't it? Yeah. And you can see that if somebody has attained, let's say, the fourth dhyana and done some of these meditations, then when they enter tantrayana, you know, it really, you know, they can do those, not just imagine doing some of those things, but actually doing them. But of course, the real thing in tantra is your meditation on emptiness. But certainly having that gives you the ability, which many of the tantric yogis have, to go to other realms and or to know things about other people, depending on the fourth dhyana. Yeah.
I was just thinking about the section about understanding the minds of others the past when I worked in hospitals and people were dying. You get kind of a glimpse into what people have been about and what's been going on in terms of how they die. And some are, you know, way out of control and fighting every minute of it. And then others are very peaceful and accepting and just, you know, going forward with it. So that's kind of a glimpse, I think, into this. And to see people that are struggling with it is so painful.
Yeah.
So painful.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you say anything to those people that helps, or do they not hear, or are their minds too stuck?
Yeah, I mean, back then people were in the hospital a long time, so you could kind of work with them. And many times it was men who were very angry. And so to help them recognize their anger and give them some support about, you know, what their mind was doing and kind of being accepting from your own side, then they would start calming down. 'Cause it seems like every person, when they get to a certain point of close to death, they know it. You can't push it away anymore. You can't ignore it anymore. It is here. And so when they're at that point, then often they can calm down. And, you know, that's a successful helping a person, I think. Yeah, not everybody, but a lot of people, actually.
A lot of people what?
That can do that.
Calm down.
Instead of being so angry and, you know, out of control and, you know, hating everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I think also as the body starts losing power and you have the absorptions, then, you know, your emotions calm down.
Here with the explanation of understanding the karma that led to rebirth in a certain realm, is this really just limited to the projecting karma, or are they able to kind of see, understand more about the completing karma? I guess I'm just wondering to what depth can they really understand all of the karmic causes and conditions?
Yeah, my guess is that some people can, and some people have to develop more ability to do that. Remember, everybody's different.
Are these super knowledges cultivated sequentially?
What?
Like, do you have to start with one and then you go to two, or do they come all at once in a batch?
You mean, what are you talking about, like remembering the different lives?
No, I mean all of these different powers.
These different powers. I have no idea. Yeah. With these, they all have their own way of being quite difficult to imagine doing. Yeah. So I would guess that, you know, it might depend on what somebody is interested in cultivating, because some people may really want to, you know, have one power or the other power. So, you know, what somebody's interested in. It might be also influenced by, how the quality of their meditation in the fourth dhyana. Yeah, so I'd imagine many different kind of factors. Yeah. I haven't heard it said whether they practice in order or not. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, we can finish this section. Shall we do that? Okay, so the sixth one is the destruction of pollutants. So those first five are all things that you can gain without being a liberated being. Yeah. So here, what does it say about the destruction of pollutants? Again, the Majjhima Nikaya says, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom that are unpolluted with the destruction of the pollutants. So remember we talked about before, liberation by mind is having the serenity and the various powers of concentration, and liberated by wisdom is realizing emptiness. Okay, and the destruction of the pollutants means you know what afflictions you've destroyed. Yeah. So according to the Prasangika Madhyamika view, this super knowledge is concomitant, it means it's at the same time and shares factors, with the concentration and wisdom that abandon afflictive obscurations. Okay, so this super knowledge is concomitant with at the end, you know, as you're abandoning afflictions, it's there because it knows that you've abandoned this affliction and not that or whatever. It directly knows these abandonments. It is possessed by Aryas who have exhaustedly abandoned all afflictive obscurations. So these Aryas are arhats. Okay. So it seems like it's not just, I've abandoned the obstructions on the path of seeing. Oh, I've abandoned the afflictions from the first bhumi and so on. It appears like it's for the whole kit and caboodle. So this includes Shravaka arhats and bodhisattvas of the pure grounds, the eighth, ninth, and tenth ground, and Buddhas. Okay, that's who have this power. In the mind streams of Buddhas, this super knowledge knows their abandonment of both the afflictive and the cognitive obscurations. In arhats, they know, and eighth ground bodhisattvas, they know the abandonment of the afflictive obscurations. According to Pali commentaries, unlike the other super knowledges, the destruction of pollutants is possessed only by arhats. It may be attained on the basis of access concentration. Ooh, that's when you preparatory to the first dhyana. That's really, you know, low. I mean, from my point of view, it's high, but from what those people do, this is a low. Okay, so it may be attained on the, you can attain arhatship on the basis of access concentration, the momentary concentration of dry insight meditators, or of any of the four dhyanas. Dry insight arhats are so called because their wisdom lacks the softening and moistening effects of the dhyanas that make the mind more receptive. Although such wisdom is hard, it can still eradicate defilements. Okay, this super knowledge realizes a liberation called the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom, which is free from defilements. When the pollutants, the fundamental defilements obscuring the mind, have been uprooted by wisdom, a meditator enters upon and dwells in the liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. So they have both of those. The liberation of mind is the concentration factor associated with the fruition statement, the attainment of arhatship, because it is free from attachment. Liberation by wisdom is the wisdom factor associated with the fruition attainment of arhatship, because it is free from ignorance. So fruition attainment means they've attained that state. Yeah. So the former, liberation by mind, is primarily the result of serenity, and the latter, liberation by wisdom, is primarily the result of insight. But coupled together like this, they refer to the fruition attainment of arhatship made accessible by the destruction of the pollutants. So that's what makes you an arhat, the destruction of the pollutants, the afflictive obscurations. The fruition attainment of arhatship is a special meditative attainment accessible to an arhat by which they directly experience nirvana through the duration of the attainment. So directly experiencing nirvana, they are absorbed in emptiness, because nirvana is a kind of emptiness. Okay, so I think we can stop here today unless people have questions, comments. Yeah.
How is this superpower different from, or is it the same as, this is a description of how an arhat attains nirvana?
How is a superpower?
This particular destruction of pollutants. How is this one? It sounds like this is the method to attain nirvana.
Yeah, this is the having attained it.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah. The method to attainment is your practice of the union of serenity and insight. This is the fruition result. Fruition means, it's the result of that. When you're an arhat, You're an arhat, what have you realized? That's the fruition result.
So it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else? So in the Buddha and the night before he attained awakening, so the three higher knowledges, the knowledge of your previous lives, giving rise to renunciation, the knowledge of the dying and rebirth of sentient beings, giving you strong compassion, and the destruction of the pollutants, accomplished by means of wisdom. So what do you have there? The three principal aspects of the path. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so we'll stop here for tonight. How do you feel hearing about all this stuff? You're so quiet. Excited?
It's awe-inspiring.
It's awe-inspiring. It sure is, isn't it? Yeah. Can
I
we?
I used to think I wanted some of the superpowers, but now I don't think I do.
Oh, that's wisdom. Okay, we'll dedicate.